early 1945, Germany's once great war machine tottered on the brink of defeat. The Allied bombing of selected industrial sites had tapered off, only to be followed by fierce attacks on German cities, designed to break the German will to resist. With the end of the war approaching, the destruction in Germany was vast. The German people still hoped for a miracle from their Führer, a secret weapon to smash the enemy and save the homeland. But Hitler's dreams of Third Reich glory were disintegrating, like the buildings and streets in which the Germans lived. But even as the Allies crossed into Germany in the spring of 1945, they met resistance. Germany had maintained a surprisingly high level of war production. Goods managed to reach German forces and provide the wherewithal to fight the Allies. Of all the symbols of German militarism, one stood out. Krupp Industries, backbone of the German military-industrial complex for generations. Though Krupp factory's headquarters in Essen had been hit by Allied bombers, beneath the rubble, much machinery was surprisingly still operable and could be saved. Krupp's managers had preserved what they could of their industrial plant and maintained 65% production. One of the American soldiers entering Essen was counterintelligence aide Alex Raffaelli. A European-born Jew, he'd earned a doctorate in political science at Heidelberg. He spoke German and Russian like a native. He was known to his colleagues in CIC 216 as a superb interrogator.
As soon as we entered Essen, I was directed to Villa Hugel, the Krupp's palatial residence and the headquarters of his enterprises. Alfred Krupp, a hard-faced man in his late 30s, stood surrounded by our military policemen at the entrance to a huge gray building that looked more like a factory than a private residence. The military policeman turned him over to us, and on the spot, I decided that he would be treated like any other Nazi prisoner.
Shortly, Raffaelli proceeded to interrogate Krupp.
Hitler's way was totalitarian. Did you approve the methods?
Life is a fight for survival, bread, and power. I'm blunt, for there is a need to be so in hours of bitter defeat. In this tough fight, we needed strong and tough leadership. Hitler gave us both.
Do you still back him? Are you a Nazi?
No, I changed. Our government cheated the people. We didn't really know what went on. We Krupps never cared much for ideologies. All we cared for is a system which is efficient and gives us the opportunity to work undisturbed. Politics is not our line.
It was the line, though, of John J. McCloy, the U.S. Assistant Secretary of War, who personally accompanied American forces into Germany. Though from a modest background, McCloy was a former Wall Street lawyer and very much of the American foreign policy establishment. 50 years old at the time, McCloy was a key policymaker who hadn't wanted to bomb the Auschwitz death camps, a diversion, he thought, from the main goal, beating the Germans. But he was shocked by what he saw of German destruction.
Here was this beautiful valley, prosperous, industrious, and seemingly contented. Certainly it should have been. And now it is a wasteland in large part. The pathetic scenes of war, people digging among their burning houses to salvage out their little possessions. Yet it was surprising to me how composed most, if not all, seemed to be. They sat among their ruins without wailing and with little strain written on their faces. Whether it was shock or the adjustment they had made to war, I do not know. This scene now for years has been perpetrated by the Germans on all of Europe. To have it come home to them is justice.
The Third Reich was in its death throes. Revelations unfolded daily. One of the most unpleasant ones had to do with the death camps. The dark side of Hitler's Germany proved darker than could ever have been imagined. A few days after McCloy's tour in the Ruhr, American troops entered the camp at Nordhausen. McCloy got a communique. There may be some secret weapons in mountain caves. The American soldiers who were there later remembered the terrible stink of death. They were shocked by what they found. Human beings, both the dead and those who had survived, but just barely. The troops found a vast underground complex dug into the mountains, camouflaged and well-protected V-2 missile factories. V-2 rockets and their components were still strewn everywhere on the ground, their secrets ripe for the taking by Allied scientists. Inside the tunnels, the factory workshops, now abandoned. The camp inmates described how they'd been Hitler's slaves, beaten and sometimes tortured if they didn't fulfill their work quotas. SS guards had been their direct supervisors, but Hitler's engineering elite, men like Wernher von Braun and Walter Dornberger, were also their bosses. The slave laborers had been designated to do their jobs and then perish, to be annihilated through their work, so they could not later tell of Nazi crimes. In the final weeks of the war, Wernher von Braun, the engineer in charge of the Nazi missile program, and many of his associates escaped with boxes of technical plans through Germany to American lines, where they deliberately gave themselves up. They believed rightly that their talent would secure them safety and even jobs. Similarly, the Russians strove for possession of Hitler's missiles and the men behind them. What had originally been developed by von Braun for Hitler formed a principal basis for both the US and Soviet missile programs. With Germany on the brink of defeat, American and Soviet troops met up by the Elbe River in April and celebrated on German soil. The taste of victory was sweet enough, but beyond the frivolity, political strains were already developing between East and West.
German delegation will now sign this this paper. And they will sign in order of seniority. And General Admiral von Friedeberg will sign first.
Soon, German troops were defeated. In four locations at the battlefront, the Nazi generals surrendered, overseen by British General Montgomery.
Now, General Kinzel will sign next.
A directive to the U.S. Commander-in-Chief in Germany stated, "The Germans cannot escape responsibility for what they have brought upon themselves." The principal Allied objective is to prevent Germany from ever again becoming a threat to the peace of the world.
Now, I will sign the instrument on behalf of the Supreme Allied Commander, General Eisenhower.
In May 1945, with Hitler already dead, the German government surrendered to Allied forces. Its most prominent leaders included General Jodl, the Chief of Staff, Admiral Dönitz, the U-boat commander and Hitler's successor as head of government, and Albert Speer, the armaments minister who'd overseen industrial production. In mid-July, the leaders of the victorious Allied powers gathered at Potsdam near Berlin in the Kaiser's former imperial palace. War against the Japanese still raged in the Pacific. The zones of influence in post-war Germany had already been agreed upon at Yalta 6 months earlier. At Potsdam, the victorious leaders sought a common policy for the administration and future of conquered Germany. The meeting marked American President Harry S. Truman's entrance onto the world stage. Just 3 months in office, Truman was outwardly cordial, but he played his cards close to his chest. For instance, at Potsdam, Truman learned that U.S. scientists had succeeded in a test explosion of an atomic bomb, but he kept this secret from everyone except his closest advisers. British Prime Minister Winston Churchill said about Truman, "A man of immense determination. He has direct methods of speech and a great deal of self-confidence and resolution." The third leader at the conference was Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin, who'd guided his vast country to victory against Germany at the cost of millions of lives. John McCloy played a backseat role at the conference, acting as an expert on Germany. He noted in his diary at the time, "It amazes me how the power to dispose the world reposes in these three men gathered here. God give them light." In the eyes of the world, there seemed a new harmony. It was only a prelude, though, to the dangers of Cold War tension. At Potsdam, the Allies did agree on a tough policy on Germany's defeated war machine. All arms, ammunition, and implements of war, and all specialized facilities for their production, shall be held at the disposal of the Allies or destroyed. It was not the Allies' intention to destroy or enslave the German people. Rather, the German people should be given the opportunity to prepare for the eventual reconstruction of their life on a democratic and peaceful basis. One of America's and the Allies' first tasks was to denazify Germany and tear down its symbols. The grip of the Nazi Party had been vast. In a nation of 50 million, over 6 million were members of the Nazi Party, which had enjoyed overwhelming support. The denazification and re-education procedures extended to 1 million people.
Die Kannibale werden. Dann wären sie ein Kannibale geworden. Na, also das sind alles Sachen, die kann ich jetzt.
Hitler's followers appeared before local boards composed of anti-Nazi Germans. To the rising skepticism of the educators, almost none of the Nazis being re-educated claimed any knowledge at all about the atrocities committed under Hitler. And in fact, millions of party members went on with their lives without punishment and completely untouched by denazification. Once, Nuremberg had been a symbol of Nazi leadership. There, Hitler had displayed Nazi pageantry at its most awesome and most beautiful. Filmmakers capturing the highlights for contemporary Germans and for posterity. Now, Nuremberg became a symbol of the Third Reich's crimes.
On Thursday, the 18th of October, 1945, in Berlin, the indictment was lodged with the tribunal.
The war crimes trials against leading Nazis opened late in 1945 in the Palace of Justice.
To each defendant
of openings of first trial in history for crimes against the peace of the world imposes a grave responsibility. The wrongs which we seek to condemn and punish have been so calculated, so malignant and so devastating that civilization cannot tolerate their being ignored because it cannot survive their being repeated.
The defendants to plead guilty or not guilty to the charges against them. Hermann Wilhelm Göring. You must plead guilty or not guilty.
Bekenne mich im Sinne der Anklage nicht schuldig.
Rudolf Hess.
Nein.
Among the defendants, Hermann Göring, Admiral Dönitz, Albert Speer, and 20 others all pleaded not guilty.
Ich kenne mich im Sinne der Anklage für nicht schuldig.
Of those being tried, two were particularly implicated in the use of forced and slave labor. Albert Speer, the Minister of War Industry.
Nicht schuldig.
As the tide of war turned against the Nazis, he oversaw the most massive regimentation of labor in history.
Ich bestätige, dass unter diesem Dokument meine Unterschrift steht.
The other was Fritz Sorkel, who was the man actually in charge of slave labor. Since the spring of 1942, he had directly supervised millions of slave and forced laborers from over a dozen countries. Speer, who was surprisingly cooperative with interrogators and prosecutors, minimized his role.
I had no influence on the method by which workers were recruited. If the workers were being brought to Germany against their will, that means, as I see it, that they were obliged by law to work for Germany. Whether the laws were justified or not, that was a matter I did not check at the time. Besides, this was no concern of mine.
Sauckel had overseen the forced transfer of millions. A memorandum produced in court dated March 1944 showed that he was fully aware of his actions. Out of 5 million foreign workers who arrived in Germany, not even 200,000 came voluntarily. The Nuremberg trials took almost a year. Of the defendants, 11 present were sentenced to death, Three were let off, while the others got jail terms ranging from 10 years to life. Fritz Sauckel got a death sentence, but felt that he'd been wronged.
I die innocently. The verdict was wrong. God protect Germany and make Germany great again. Let Germany live, and God protect my family.
Speer got off with 20 years. Among the few who were cooperative and contrite, he wrote later that the verdicts weighed little compared to the misery we'd brought upon the world. With literally several million soldiers back home, thousands wandered the streets in search of jobs and food. Many Germans grew sickened by the waste. With considerable industrial plants still standing, the most obvious corporate offenders, like IG Farben, had some of their factories blown up. Many of the old firms, Krupp, Siemens, Daimler-Benz, and the components of IG Farben, were effective monopolies and the ground rock of the Nazi regime's military might. They were the target of what the Allies called dismantlement and decartelization, designed to break their exclusive hold on economic power. Often, the Allies tried by decree to mold German swords into plowshares, to eliminate German armament and assure the end of Germany's military might. At one of the old Messerschmitt plants, propaganda films showed that once sophisticated machine tools and molding equipment could transform an assembly line from churning out warplanes to milk cans. The process of economic recovery in Germany was painfully slow. The harsh winter of 1946 brought deprivation. There was little food. It became known as the hunger winter. In 1947, a year later, the United States made a dramatic and major step towards the recovery of post-war Europe. The new Secretary of State, General George Marshall, called for massive and coordinated European economic recovery. The American aid became known as the Marshall Plan. The Western zones of occupation in Germany were surprisingly included as the major recipients. As capital flowed into Germany, many of the same German companies that had worked for the Nazis now applied their energies to peacetime product and to providing jobs for German workers. Even as German industry began to revive, a second round of trials known as the Nuremberg Economic Trials began in August 1947. The accused were top industrialists, such as Alfred Krupp, Friedrich Flick, and the IG Farben managers, men who'd been the backbone of German industry during the war effort. These Nuremberg trials were more controversial than the first. Many Germans saw them as a kind of revenge of the victors, aimed at satisfying Western public opinion and keeping Germany down. Prosecutors bared the industrial underside of the German war machine, providing evidence that Alfred Krupp had both supervised war production and was an active member of the Nazi Party. He regularly exchanged intelligence information. A Krupp factory at the Auschwitz death camp complex produced fuses for the war effort. Krupp had permitted, even encouraged, slave labor, signing detailed contracts with the SS. Thousands had died from hunger and beatings, not just at Auschwitz, but in company factories at Essen. On July the 31st, 1948, after 9 months of trial, Alfred Krupp was sentenced along with 9 members of the firm's board of directors. Krupp received a 12-year sentence, which he'd quite expected. But then, surprisingly, the judges announced that both his personal and company property would be confiscated, thus shattering the Krupp dynasty. Witnesses recalled that Krupp grew faint. Germany's economy required financing and stability. On June the 20th, 1948, an Allied program for currency reform called Operation Bird Dog was introduced, ostensibly to stem the black market. The Soviets saw it as a step towards Germany's partition and the creation of a West German state. That would end their own hopes for a neutral Germany and reparations to the Soviets from Ruhr area industrialists. The Soviets reacted. They restricted access to West Berlin, cutting off the overland routes and shutting down electricity. As the conflict mounted, the Western powers and the Soviets publicly condemned each other for outright violations of the Potsdam Accord. For the next 9 months, the Berlin blockade, a turning point in the gathering Cold War between East and West. In immediate response, the Berlin airlift, a climactic moment in resistance to what the West saw as communist aggression. The Americans and British sent B-29s and hundreds of other aircraft, demonstrating support for the recently vanquished Germans against the newly emerging enemy, the Soviet Union. From the moment of blockade and airlift, a state in West Germany became inevitable. There would be one come hell or high water, in the words of U.S. Secretary of State Dean Acheson. Berlin became a divided city. Both East and West recognized an underlying truth, that Germany was at the heart of Europe and its future. Geographically as well as ideologically, Germany was also a divided country, into 4 zones, one for each of the major Western allies. And with the Soviet zone decidedly separate from the others. The Berlin blockade brought about a remarkable transformation of the German public image in the West. The once evil Germans were transformed into symbols of resistance to communist aggression. As one senior American officer, Walter Bidell Smith, put it,
"Our present hysterical outburst of humanitarian feelings about the Germans keeps reminding me that just 3.5 years ago, I would have been considered a hero if I had succeeded in exterminating those same Germans with bombs."
With military rule due to be replaced by a civilian one, a new Allied and American leadership came to Germany. It included John J. McCloy, who had in the meantime been a banker and presidential advisor. McCloy was entrusted with shepherding Germany through its rebirth. One of his first acts as military governor was to impose a law securing reparations for victims of Nazism.
"So far as I am concerned, I cannot forget the Auschwitzes and the Dachaus, and I do not want the German people to forget them either. If they do, they will start their new German state in an atmosphere of moral degeneration and degradation."
McCloy's German counterpart was an unlikely 73-year-old, Konrad Adenauer. He headed a conservative, religiously-based political party, the Christian Democratic Union. Adenauer got his political start during Weimar days as the pre-Nazi mayor of the city of Cologne. A conservative Catholic, both anti-Nazi and anti-communist, he'd been imprisoned briefly during World War II by the Nazis. He emerged from the war with a record unstained by Nazism. But he was a proud, even unrelenting nationalist with a talent for personal and political survival. In August, the new West Germany had its first elections. It was only 4 years after the horrors and tragedy of World War II. During the heat of the campaign, Adenauer insisted, the foreigners must understand that the period of collapse and unrestricted domination by the Allies is finished. The issue of jobs and hard times dominated the debate. Adenauer, contrary to what was agreed at Potsdam, was determined to end external limitations on Germany's industry. Many Germans thought that dismantlement was aimed not against German militarism, but against rising German competition with Western firms. Adenauer's party won, but only just. In the Bundestag, West Germany's parliament, he was elected chancellor and had the opportunity to form a government. And in September 1949, that democratically elected government took power. Soon after that, Adenauer, as head of the new government, came to the Petersburg Castle just outside Bonn to meet the Allied High Commissioners. He presented them with West Germany's new basic law. The new state was a fact.
I can assure the German people that they start on their journey attended by the great hope and goodwill of the people of the United States, who will follow the progress of the new government with the greatest interest.
The Soviets protested that the formation of a new government was a violation of the Potsdam agreements. Now, they took steps to create a second German state, this one communist-run, the German Democratic Republic, founded on October the 7th, 1949, with East Berlin as its capital. As a heavy iron curtain rang down in Germany, there was developing bitterness. East German leaders threatened that Adenauer and other Western leaders would face trials before people's courts. One of Adenauer's first acts as Chancellor was to visit divided Berlin, where he urged the end of foreign occupation. But he was in fact ready to tolerate a division of his country so long as West Germany was linked with the West.
Meine lieben Berliner, ich bin tief beeindruckt durch das, was ich heute hier sehe.
Adenauer and McCloy together soon faced their first major issue: the extent to which actual dismantling of German industry should be carried out. Adenauer asserted that with hard times ahead, Germany's economic future was at stake. Shortly, McCloy retreated and then succumbed. He recorded that dismantling is a lost cause. But he still urged the destruction or removal of all machinery that could be used for war-making purposes. Soon, McCloy and his fellow commissioners and Adenauer hammered out an agreement soothing French fears about a revived Germany. All dismantling of industry would be ended in West Berlin, which desperately needed jobs, and 17 lesser industries elsewhere. Germany could build ocean liners, produce 11 million tons of steel yearly, join the World Bank and the Council of Europe. In return, Germany agreed to stay disarmed. As the decade of the 1940s came to a close, a series of events not in Germany but elsewhere spurred a crisis atmosphere. In August 1949, the Soviets exploded their own atomic bomb, breaking the American monopoly and increasing Germany's vulnerability to Soviet threat. From Eastern Europe to faraway China, communists took power, establishing governments and the momentum for takeovers elsewhere. And then, in June 1950, the North Koreans marched south in an attempt to conquer all of the divided peninsula. To many Westerners, it seemed that communism had embarked on a global march of domination. There was fear that the communists had their eye on Germany as well. Konrad Adenauer saw the opportunity to further Germany's rehabilitation. He offered German troops to help the West. McCloy refused the offer. But it opened the door to German rearmament. Back in Germany, West Germans and the Americans feared Soviet conventional military superiority and even an invasion. In the brink-of-war atmosphere, Adenauer called for Western measures to assure West Germans that they would have the chance to defend their country in the event of an emergency. He asked for a West German police force, but was refused. As the countercharges between East and West became more bitter, McCloy supported measures to clear Germany's conscience and rehabilitate its name. Under Adenauer, Germany began negotiations with Israel and Jewish groups for reparation payments to Hitler's victims. Adenauer mounted pressure on McCloy to halt denazification and modify the Nuremberg sentences. A specially appointed board, after a year's review, recommended widespread clemency. In January 1951, in an action that many outside Germany found shocking, McCloy commuted, paroled, or reduced sentences on 79 of 89 war criminals. He affirmed only 5 of 9 death sentences. Most Germans reacted positively. The most controversial of the decisions had to do with Alfred Krupp. McCloy released him, effectively sweeping much of Germany's Nazi past under the rug. McCloy also restored the Krupp family fortune overnight, making a convicted war criminal one of the world's richest men. Alfred Krupp came back home, welcomed by friends, family, and Krupp workers and managers. Though there were still demands for its dissolution, in effect, the Krupp firm was preserved. In Germany, it was business as usual.
Trailblazers, join the adventurers.
It's a perfect spot for a base camp.
Some German industrialists who were part of Hitler's war machine, such as Professor Willy Messerschmitt, never faced trial. Messerschmitt initially bided his time. He, like others, was prevented by Allied decree from aircraft production in Germany. But operating out of a Munich base, he took his design genius to Switzerland and Austria and then to Spain. In the early 50s, renewing old ties in Franco's Spain, he developed the HA-200 jet fighter for the Spanish Air Force. Later, he would take the same design plans to Egypt. Messerschmitt and his revived firm would be ready for the day when fuller German sovereignty would be restored and aircraft production could be resumed. Hitler had promised that a mass-produced vehicle would become available to every German. Adenauer fulfilled the promise. Germany's traditional industries, such as chemicals, the leading firms came from the elements of the dismantled IG Farben, resumed their activity. At plants like Krupp, Germany returned to its base in iron, coal, steel, and other heavy industrial production. Some, especially in France, feared that Germany would use its economic revival to rearm. To counter that possibility, an idea arose from France to unite the two countries' iron, steel, and coal industries into a single market. Frenchman Jean Monnet and French Foreign Minister Robert Schuman brokered an agreement with Adenauer known as the Schuman Plan that could lead to European economic unity. The Americans thought it a good idea. More important, the Germans did. Adenauer said that there's no better way of dispelling French doubts about the German people's love of peace than to bring together the two countries' coal, iron, and steel, which are ever the mainstay of rearmament. The Schuman Plan, designed to keep German rearmament under control, stirred hopes for European unity and a more peaceful future. In 1953, with discontent rife, the people of East Germany revolted against Soviet rule. The Russians forcefully reasserted their control.
Bitte Sie, meine Damen und Herren.
In Western eyes, the need for a German army against potential communist aggression seemed ever greater. Yet, deep-seated fears about German militarism lingered. Chancellor Adenauer made a German army a more palatable idea by agreeing to Allied demands to renounce weapons of mass destruction, such as atomic bombs. The Germans finally ratified their participation in an all-European defense force. A new German army integrated into a European one. But French fears about Germany caused the French Parliament, in a heated debate in August 1954, to vote it down. Within Germany itself, there were deep divisions about rearmament. Some were afflicted by a crisis of conscience and rejected the entire thrust of Germany's past. Instead, favoring pacifism, neutrality, and opposing the idea of a new German army. But the Cold War had become a dominant reality. Though the European Defense Force was voted down, the Americans insisted that West Germany assume a military responsibility. In 1955, the governments of NATO, including France, agreed to accept West Germany into the organization. Only 10 years after the defeat of Nazi Germany, the vanquished joined hands with the victors in a military alliance. East Germany's soldiers became part of the Soviet-backed Warsaw Pact. And forces from both Germanies served where their superpowers, with their nuclear warheads, faced off against each other at the heart of a troubled and divided Europe. For over half a century, Germany's war machine manufactured iron and spilled blood. As one writer put it, was a past both impossible to remember and impossible to forget. II, Germany's new generation strove somehow to step out from the darkness of Hitler's shadow.